Well, let's go back to the passage. Now, let me review. Remember chapter 13, we kind of started a new section where it sort of reviews in a new way, in a new perspective, what we'd seen at the beginning of the book in the prior chapters, where we see through the cross the birth of the church and see how life is operating in that context. And we saw that in chapter 13, we have the birth of the church through the birth and life of Jesus, who is from the people of God, who faced all the temptations and dangers, and who nonetheless fulfilled his mission of dying on the cross, leading to salvation to men in every tribe, nation, on earth, and creating the church. And ironically, the church is preserved in the wilderness of a fallen world, which you wouldn't think that, and it's meant to be paradoxical, but it is. Satan has been kicked out of heaven. He failed to stop Jesus fulfilling his mission, though he sent Herod to try to kill him as a baby, though he tried to stop him in many ways, tempt him, struggle with him. Satan has failed. This defeat means that now it's clear that his final defeat is obvious and inevitable. And he is fighting a losing war now, not one where there's any serious hope on his part. There never was, but he might have had a serious hope. That serious hope is gone. For the people on the earth who are not believers, this means they've got an angry Satan running around. That's not good news for them. For heaven, heaven rejoices. For believers, the picture is ambiguous. In essence, it's good news. Satan can no longer accuse us before God. And you notice, being accused before God is a very bad thing. Think of what happened to Job when Satan accused him before God. On the whole, you don't want to be accused before God anyhow, but it can lead to consequences even here on the earth. But we nonetheless face Satan's hostility while we live our time on this earth. And he attacks the church in a variety of ways in which he is trying to derail God's plans to save his people. Of course, he's going to fail because those people who are his are sealed and protected, as we've seen in the earlier chapters. But he uses lots of mechanisms. Persecution is one, and the seven churches face that. False teachers is another one. Sinful hypocrisy on the part of people who claim to be believers, and actually some churches, unbelievers in very visible and powerful positions. Of course, that's part of the false teaching group as well, but there are others. And just general sin in the church. And since we're all sinners, that happens even among people who are genuine believers. But nonetheless, he's lost. And his power is more constrained. Now, we're going to see in the chapters going forward that Satan still has a role to play, and he still has a counterattack. Of course, we've seen it through the challenges in the church. And we're going to see the means that he tries to use. He's going to raise up a beast. In fact, he's going to raise up two beasts. And the one beast is alluded to in Daniel extensively from the sea, which kind of seems to represent kind of the chaotic, sinful, fallen world where from time to time people emerge that you would not have expected them to have emerged. And the second beast is going to be the system that those sinful governments, sinful authorities raise up, utilize. And we'll talk about more about the two beasts later. The second beast will be include things like false religion and heretical religion. We'll talk about that some too. And in chapter 14, is which we'll start in a minute, or maybe today, we're going to see some of his counterattacks. Now, Satan himself creates nothing, but he perverts and twists and caricatures God's blessing. So, for example, he cannot create providence, but he has a kind of evil providence, a corrupt providence that he uses. That's how he calls up the beasts. We'll talk more about that too. So it's kind of a caricature of what God does. And of course, his evil teachers are caricatures of the truth that God gives us for our salvation. And similarly, we'll see him give temporary human rewards to those that follow his system, which again is a caricature of God's eternal, glorious reward for his true followers. So Satan is basically caricaturing God's great blessing as he operates. Now I'm going to give an example of a caricature that shows Satan's evil providence. The rise of a beast. Now, this is not Karen's favorite thing when I go into history for a while. Nonetheless, I think it helps us get a better feel for what it really means that Satan calls up beasts from the sea by sea of beasts that he called up in the 20th century. In this case, a man named Adolf Hitler. Now, if you were thinking about calling up someone as your beast, you might think Hitler was a fairly poor choice, just looking at him. He had several handicaps. He was an Austrian who lived in Germany, so he's a foreigner. And there are lots of Germans that didn't like that. Because he was an Austrian, presumed to be Catholic and considered nominally Catholic. There were lots of Germans that didn't like that. In fact, German Catholics were handicapped legally. They could vote, but there were things they couldn't do. So he was in a group that was not particularly popular. And in fact, there were people in Germany who greatly disliked Hitler and were very hostile to his rise to power. He had tried to overthrow the government, and he spent a year in jail. That would normally not make you very politically packageable. And he was a nobody. He'd been a corporal in World War I, and he was a foreigner. He hadn't done anything before that. But he had some assets from Satan's point of view. And Satan is not stupid. He picks the right instrument for his source. He has no moral principles. Well, you might not think of that as an asset, but from Satan's point of view, that's a wonderful asset. He also, because of this, has no political principles that he really believes in one sense. Hitler is quite willing to change his political ideas very quickly and make incredibly what you wouldn't have thought of doing something you wouldn't have expected him to do for a while. So he's a super pragmatist, and he's quite willing to hide his views, his real views. In fact, a lot of his real views we don't even know, even now. He's a gambler. He's willing to take risk, which if you're going to try to become a beast and you're starting out as nobody, you have to be someone who's willing to take risk. His country does not in this case, Germany does not have a long history of democracy, and it has some constitutional quirks because of that, which are going to greatly help Hitler as he comes to power. And his country has taken great pain in the recent past and will take more pain in the time that Hitler is attempting to rise to power, which also is going to help his rise to power. But he has one other attribute that makes him really valuable to Satan. And that attribute we're going to see many times in his career. He is very good. This is kind of his modus operandi, at seeing what others want and figuring out a way to give it to them in such a way so that he gets what he wants. You know, we all teach our children these principles of how to live, even when we don't intend to. I remember when I was a boy and my parents would be riding along and they'd see somebody driving a fancy car, and my parents would say, "Smart people buy nice houses that appreciate. Stupid people buy fancy cars that depreciate anyhow." By the way, I drive a 20-year-old Toyota Camry. You know? So you see, those things last, you know. Well, Hitler's big principle was, hey, look, if you want to control people, you figure out what they want. You figure out a way to give it to them, but you do it in such a way so you get what you want. And it turned out he used that principle with incredible skill in his life. And perhaps more than any other thing, that's going to be a critical thing as we watch his story unfold. So Hitler gets out of jail, and he tries to go legit. He says to the party that he was a part of, let's do it constitutionally. We're not going to be able to take over by force. And his party wasn't real thrilled about that. They thought that was a dumb idea. And at first, it did look like a dumb idea. Hitler said, well, just a second. We'll make our party very appealing. I'm going to make it socialist because it's a working class party. And working class people like socialism. By the way, we tend to think of fascists as ultra-right wingers. In the 20s, Hitler was viewed as a liberal party. Not a right-wing party. We'll see how that changed presently. We're going to be nationalistic, though, because Germany just lost this terrible war and got crushed at Versailles. It's gone through a lot of pain. And workers are very nationalistic, too. And, as it turns out, one of our big rivals, the communists, have the handicap that they come from a foreign power and people view them as anti-German. And there were lots of communists, and they were going to be an opponent of his in the 20s. And one of the big assets Hitler had against them was they were viewed as foreign-dominated by Russia. Hitler was German-geared. And his third big proposition was, we'll be anti-Semitic. Now, anti-Semitic was very popular in Germany, especially among working class people, for two reasons. One, working class people in Europe were always anti-Semitic. Jews had had jobs that involved lending money. People don't really like bankers that they owe money to that much. They had often had businesses where they worked for people, and you get a lot of hostility towards people that you work towards. And this had gone on for hundreds of years. They weren't Christian. Europe wasn't. Germany wasn't Christian at that time either, but it was nominally Christian at least. They also, however, had a particularly big handicap in the 20s. People don't notice this very well, but this was a great asset to Hitler in his rise to power. In the early 20s, right after World War I, a government came to power that was socialistic. And they're the ones that ran the great inflation that wiped out the savings of people in Germany who were kind of middle class and working class people. If you were 60 and that thing occurred, it was bad news. And Jews were part of that cabinet. But at the same time, there was a class of people, speculators, who made a bundle out of this, basically by buying land and borrowing a ton against it. And they wound up getting to buy all this land for nothing because of the inflation. And a lot of them were Jews as well. So there was a particularly, weren't the same Jews, don't get me wrong, but it was like, it was not a good combination to have to make you popular. Even so, in the elections of 1928, he got 1.2% of the vote. So he wasn't doing very well, despite his pragmatic plan. Didn't look like he was going to matter much. Now, in 1928, Germany was prosperous. She didn't have a lot of inflation. So it looked like the Nazis were dead. They're going to be a minor party. Hitler did have one asset, though. He had a loyal group of people. Group of people who, generally speaking, were working people and who'd kind of lost in society out considerably. And they were very loyal to him because he seemed to have a way of making them feel important and good. This was part of his ability to figure out what people wanted and give it to him. And he had a big organization called the SA, which was later to be abolished, but the SA was kind of a big group of thugs that went around making him forceful. Fortunately for Hitler, the communists also had big groups that did that, so it kind of gave him a little cover, as he got a way to do that. So Hitler made a forecast after the election of 28. Now, let me tell you, if an investment manager made a forecast this good, he'd be a billionaire. He said, oh yeah, things are good now, but the United States is going to pull its loans, and that's the only basis for your prosperity, and unemployment's going to go through the roof. Now, Hitler was no economist. He probably said it because he hoped it would happen. It did happen. The next year, in 1929, the stock market crashed, America pulled its loans, German unemployment went from 3% to 18% in 90 days. Hitler looked like he was the prophet of the age. And this led into a Great Depression when fringe parties like the National Socialists did well and the established parties fell apart. It's kind of like what happened in Greece when they were trying to be on the euro and they got pounded and all the established parties got destroyed and the people in control were people in these parties you'd never heard of 2 years ago. But Hitler had the advantage over the other fringe parties that he had made this great forecast. I'd call that the evil providence of Satan, that he could do that right there. Well, now we go into the Depression. Radical parties are being helped. Hitler is being helped. And the world economy keeps going down. This is not a German depression. This is a world depression. And basically every government in the world that had the misfortune of being elected in 28 or 29 and taking power then got creamed. And somebody else came to power. The depression, the Nazis are getting more and more votes. They get more and more important. Now, Hitler has an enemy. The president of Germany is Hindenburg, and he chooses who's going to be the new chancellor or premier or prime minister, whatever you call it. But you're supposed to have majority support from the parliament. He won't pick Hitler. He hates Hitler. First off, he's Protestant. He's Prussian. He's German to the core. He doesn't like Austrian Catholics. Hitler had the audacity to run against him as president one time. Everything about Hitler he hates. And in fact, his right-wing business allies hate Hitler too because of his socialism. So Hitler is viewed as unacceptable. And this goes on. And in fact, Hindenburg puts in one government after another and they all fail because the Nazis have 41% of the Reichstag. And they have a party they're allied with has 10. That's 51%. So nobody else can get more than 49% of the votes, even if they get every other vote in the Reichstag. And trying to unite the communists with the Catholics, with everybody else is going to be pretty tough anyhow. So government after government falls. Now, This is all happening while the Depression is getting worse. Finally, in January of 33, they cut a deal. And Hitler gets to be premier. What does he do to get that deal? He disbands the SA. He kills the head of the SA, who had usually been viewed as the number two guy in the Nazi party until that moment. The pragmatism and the socialism is gone. Now, the newspapers noted this, but Hitler's premier. And what a time to be premier. January of 1933 was the absolute, it probably was the bottom month of the Great Depression, in Europe especially. Anybody who came to power in early 33 was going to be very, very popular because the economy was going to have gone straight down and then straight back up. So it was perfectly fortuitous that Hindenburg had held him off until the absolute bottom. Hindenburg, of course, was not particularly pleased about this, but he really didn't have a choice. But Hitler, by getting rid of the SA, defanged a lot of the right-wing opposition of the businessmen. From henceforth, socialist was a name, no longer the political reality of the party. Now, this was a risky thing to do. If things hadn't gone right, and his working-class people felt he had broken faith with them, the next elections might have been not so good. Ha ha ha. But the evil providence of Satan intervenes. A stupid Dutch, a foreign communist, goes in and burns down the parliament about a month into office. Hitler's just been in office a month. When I was a boy, we were taught in school, actually, the Nazis did it, and they were just lucky this Dutch guy was running around. But nowadays, we're pretty sure he actually did it for them. Talk about a break. A foreign communist burns down the parliament. They had new elections. Hitler jumps from 41 to 44. With his allied party, his majority is a little stronger. So he's reaffirmed as premier in these very quick snap elections. And the whole government is in turmoil. Now, Hitler, at that moment, evokes a thing called the Enablement Act. We don't have anything like that in our Constitution. But the Enablement Act in Germany enabled the parliament with a supermajority to give someone to be the head of the whole government. I mean, absolute power. So the parliament wouldn't meet for 5 years, and that guy had all parliament. But it took a really big majority, and Hitler didn't have anything like that. Now, he got to arrest a bunch of communists, plus having gained some votes in the election, but he's still way short. Well, Hitler is nothing if he is not pragmatic. So guess what he does? He goes to the Roman Catholic Church, which controls a big party called the Center Party, which has been the bulwark of democracy in Germany. Now, the Catholics think of him as like a Catholic. He's Austrian, so obviously he's a Catholic, right? He's nominally a Catholic. And Mussolini has just signed a deal with the church in Italy, and Hitler realizes the church would like the same deal, where Catholics are no longer discriminated against as Catholics and that sort of thing. And so he offers it. And the church says, oh, yeah. And the Center Party is instructed to vote for the Enablement Act. And suddenly Hitler has been made absolute dictator. The only thing left is Hindenburg. But Hindenburg is 87 years old and he's sick and he dies in 1934. So he's not going to be able to do much. And Hitler just waits for him to die and then takes over the presidency as well. And now he is absolute master of Germany. And now Hitler proceeds to do some gambles. He remilitarizes, violating Versailles, and holds his breath. Well, the British and French had taken huge casualties in World War I, and what they got out of the war was nothing. So they don't have a taste for going around saying, let's get in a fight with somebody. So they let him do it. he remilitarizes the Rhineland, which had been demilitarized by the Treaty of Versailles. They let him do that, to put his army in the Rhineland. Only one guy gets in his way, and that's Mussolini. He tried to take over Austria, and Mussolini says, uh-uh, you're not going to do that. And he backs off. He doesn't have, Mussolini had a bigger army at that time than he did. So Hitler backs off. You know what Hitler does then? He's going to do the same thing he always does. He's going to win over Mussolini. Remember how Mussolini was called Duce, which means the boss in Italian? Hitler now becomes the Führer, which means leader in German. He takes that from Mussolini. He starts wearing military uniforms. Up until that time, he wore civilian clothes. He starts imitating Mussolini's speaking style, kind of the radical speaking style you see on television where Hitler's going, we picked that up from Mussolini, which is what Mussolini did. Mussolini loved it. And then when Britain and France got mad at Mussolini over his invasion of Ethiopia, all of a sudden Hitler was his buddy. And instead of having Italy as an opposing force, they became allies. Once again, Hitler has figured out what somebody wants and has seduced them. And of course, this was a disaster for Italy in the long run. Hitler also now realizes Britain and France have no taste for conflict. So this does let him, in 1938, unite Austria with Germany, which was pretty popular in Austria, actually. First off, they were all German-speaking people, and secondly, Hitler was an Austrian, which made it a lot easier for that to happen. He also picks up Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. Europe isn't willing to fight about that either. Hitler has correctly discerned that. Sudetenland is also all German. They were Austrian, other part of the Austrian Empire that had Germans in it. It had been given to Czechoslovakia for defensive purposes, but by the Treaty of Versailles. But most Germans would have felt this was naturally part of their country. Then Britain and France back off again. Nor is the United States interested. We're isolationists, and the United States is busy with its own problems. Let me just mention Roosevelt and Morgenthau, even though they have a great reputation for solving the Great Depression, Morgenthau was his Secretary of Treasury. Morgenthau wrote a paper when I was in college on Morgenthau and his diaries. He knew nothing of finance and was completely ignorant, adopted exactly the wrong kind of policies. 37 through 40, we're in the second part of the Great Depression. The rest of the world is booming. It didn't hurt Roosevelt's reputation very much, but it certainly meant we were preoccupied with something other than what was going on over in Europe. Finally, he takes over the rest of Czechoslovakia, and the people in Europe realize this guy's got to be dealt with. And guess what? Hitler brings back his one great skill. He goes to Stalin, Russia, and says, now what does Stalin want? I know. I'll tell him, well, you can take over Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, half of Poland when I invade it, and Bessarabia, which that's all the kind of borderlands that had all been part of the Russian Empire before World War I. So Stalin gets all that real estate. And of course he's going to be buddies with Hitler. I mean, in fact, he even got more land in Poland than Hitler did. If you look at how they divided up Poland, Stalin got about 60% of Poland, Hitler only got 40%. The British and French didn't declare war on Stalin for doing this because even they realized fighting Russia and Germany wasn't going to be a very good idea. Now, the British and French still don't want to go to war. I mean, they declared war when he attacks Poland, but they're very enthused about it, and they do nothing while he wipes out Poland. And then when the Russians invade, it doesn't take long. They have done nothing, and they still don't prepare for the war. I mean, it's very interesting how they just kind of lethargically sit there. and let Hitler revamp his army, move it back to the other part of the country. And the governments of Britain and France are just kind of saying, oh, everything's fine. We have a blockade against Germany, which, as it turns out, did no harm to Germany whatsoever. Well, the beast has been raised. The rest is history. I mean, we all know what happened. The other thing that we see in Hitler, in his pragmatism, I just want one more point. Hitler had gotten to power on an anti-Semitic platform. But then he stopped talking about the Jews altogether for a couple of years when he was building up his power. That was no longer helpful to him. He didn't have to run in elections, and it didn't make him reputable in the world. So he didn't talk about it. All of a sudden, it was like that went away for a couple of years. It wasn't until later, and later in the 30s, once his power was consolidated in Germany and much stronger, and after he had built up his military, that this happened. Oh, and one other thing that all this did that helped Hitler was the solution to getting out of a depression is to spend a lot of government money that you borrow. When you build up a big army, you actually do exactly what you do to help make your economy recover, and Germany actually kind of was one of the leaders in the recovery. In fact, in the 34, 35 period, 36 period, the cost of a tank was negative. Right, as you got more GNP from the external side effects and lowering unemployment than it cost you to build the tank or the plane. Talk about a great time to live when you're building up your army and no one else wants to. Well, I spent a lot of time on this, but I want you to see how beasts come to power. Provenance, combined with they have the right temperament. You can see then that the beasts, that you can see how Satan could raise up a beast. Now, you can see in a human sense, anyhow. And if, by the way, one of the things that impressed me was, I've been very interested in the subject of how Hitler came to power, because in my classrooms I didn't get very good answers to that question, and so I looked into it. I realized that when I was taught in school, people deliberately obscured all the things like his forecast in 28, that Great Depression occurring at exactly that point, Hindenburg's opposition fading just at the right moment. All the things which were fortuitous, or fortuitous is the wrong word to use, right? Let's call it Satan's imitation fortuitousness. People didn't want anyone, it was like they made the Dutch communists nothing, made the Nazis set the fire. They went out of their way to obscure the fact that there was a power here moving to bring a beast into office. Now, how does the... Let's go back to... Oh, we haven't started reading chapter 14. Maybe we ought to read that for a few verses here. I think chapter 13 is actually the one I'm reading. Chapter 12 was the one I summarized. Okay. And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but it had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of the lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. Now, how does the dragon, which is Satan, have the ability to do this? Theologically, we've been talking about human things so far. What's where does he get this authority to do such a thing? God is in sovereign control. What's going on? That's a question for you. I've lulled you to sleep by talking for a while, but now you have to think.
Yeah, in terms of thinking about Hitler and his rise to power, I'm wondering if he is looking for people who are willing to give themselves over and, in a sense, be used by him, and no matter what the consequences are.
Certainly, in a human sense, I think Satan did pick Hitler. His lack of morals and his total pragmatism in the most negative sense possible made him a great asset. So yeah, in a human sense, that's very true, what you're saying. Satan has the ability and the judgment to pick the right person who will make a perfectly awful beast when he is in power. That's true.
It seems like your question has at least two possible answers. One, that God allowed this to happen, and the other, that God couldn't prevent it. And those aren't the same, but those are two possible answers.
Okay. God couldn't prevent it.
I don't like either one of them.
I don't like God couldn't prevent it either. Allowed it. That's an interesting term. People often say that. He clearly had to have given his consent and permission. Let's think back. Let's think about that question, though. How is God's sovereignty related to the beast being able to do this, or to the dragon being able to do it? See, now we've gone to a very hard question. Well, let's... Ah, good. Carrie.
It's God's story. It's not man's story. It's not Satan's story. It's God's story.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't always give me peace.
Mm-hmm.
Personal peace, because I'm not, I know he'll never leave me or forsake me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to get radiation. He never left me or forsake me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always know the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I know that God is good.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it's his story. I know that I'm weak and that he's strong.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Everything you said is true, isn't it? Yes, go ahead.
I guess I have another.
I'm wondering if the story of when Ahab was tempted to go into battle, and there's that scene in heaven where God says, who will tempt Ahab to go into mm-hmm. battle? And then some say this, some say that, and one comes up and says, I will become a lying spirit in his prophet's mouth. And God says, you will succeed. And I'm wondering if there's something in the background where spiritually that could have some bearing on this.
Okay. That there's a spiritual issue raising here. Yeah, this is, see, we struggle with this, don't we? This is a hard issue. I will give John his paces over here.
With due respect to the honorable woman in the back, I would say that there's a third possibility, at least, and that God ordained it. So there's a difference to me between, did God ordain it? Is God allowing it? And is God not able to stop mm-hmm. it? So for me, I mean, this is all, nothing's happening that's surprising to him. I don't think he's, I mean, this goes into my, I guess, other theological views, but I don't think he's looking down the road and seeing what Satan's going to do and then deciding, like, I mean, he's in control of all of it. So for me, there's a difference between saying God allowed it, which maybe from our perspective he does, and God ordained it theologically, which is an interesting, okay, I think, question to consider.
Okay, he ordained it. Oh, well, now we're starting to get a few more. She gets to go first because she's easier to get to.
Mine's just really brief. You know, I go back to Job, and God, there was that conversation in Job, and God allowed him in order to show his glory, his power in the end.
So. Okay. By the way, let me talk about Job for a minute. You notice Job has some interesting elements. God brought up Job, not Satan. And God said to Satan at one point, even though you incited me to ruin him without cause, to Satan. It looks like God's in control as we read that passage. Which makes this all a very interesting question. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, sorry. When I thought of my third possibility besides allow and can't prevent, I thought caused it. Does ordained mean caused? I don't know what ordained means.
Yes, ordained means cause, but for a good reason, is probably the way you'd normally say ordained. It means caused it, but sometimes we use the word caused with a negative. If the outcome is negative, if we say somebody caused something, we're usually saying something negative about him. In the case of when you use the word God ordained, you mean God caused it, but he did so for good reasons. That's why that word is a little different.
We've been studying the book of Acts in our small group, and there's a lot of parallels, I think, between Acts and Romans. I'm sorry, Acts and Revelation, sorry. In Acts, you see the persecution of the church in many cases. In Revelation, you see that Satan is behind the persecution of the church. Mm-hmm. For example, there's an example, well, right at the very beginning in Pentecost, Peter's sermon is, you know, you, the Roman Empire, you Romans, you wanted to kill Jesus, but it was actually God's plan, mm-hmm, to let you do that, that good could come out of your evil. And then later in Acts, chapters like 7, 8, 9, 10, there's a lot of persecution after Stephen's speech, and they get scattered. But the narrator says, but they took the gospel with them, and they ended up sharing the gospel in many places because they were scattered because of persecution. Persecution is not a good thing, and the people probably suffering it didn't quite understand why it was happening. But the narrator, the book of Acts, looks back and probably says, hey, you know, God was spreading the gospel, as he said he would in Acts 1, because of the persecution, interestingly, not necessarily intentionally from their point of view, but God, mm-hmm, did have a purpose. And sometimes we don't see it when we're in the middle of it, but it's still there.
Right. The persecutors didn't think they were doing God's will.
They were against God, but then God overcame them, quite literally.
Yes. Yeah, good. Yeah. Mara says I have 2 minutes or something left. I talk too much about Hitler. Sometimes people intend evil, but God has another intent for what they're doing. We see this in the Old Testament articulated in a variety of passages. I don't have enough time to read the one I was going to read, which has 25 verses in Isaiah. So I will summarize it for you. In Isaiah chapter 10, God says, woe to Assyria. But then he says, Assyria is the rod of my anger. It's the instrument of my judgment. It's what I have called forth. But Assyria does not so intend. Therefore, when he has done my strange task, I will punish Assyria. Same thing's happening to Satan. Satan thinks he's going to thwart God. He probably thought killing him on a cross would shut things down, didn't work out that way. And he probably thought persecuting the church would shut things down. It didn't work that way either. And sometimes, like in Sally's case, persecution seems to lead to God's glory and people being saved. So if your perspective is, did God create history in order to maximize our comfort? No. We live in a fallen world, and there's lots of pain and suffering in that world. But he did create history to save every single one of his elected people, without exception. And Jesus will not come until the last elected person is saved. There will be none lost. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but when I pray for, this makes me very ambiguous when I pray. Kind of like, we're supposed to pray for Jesus' glory in the coming kingdom in a vague sense, but you know, if you have little grandchildren and you're not quite sure whether or not they're believers yet or not, kind of like, well, let me wait a little while on that prayer. Come after the, I know they're believers. But of course, there's somebody else with little grandchildren that's going to be in the same situation. So I think that it's very hard for us to see just how perfect his plan is. And when Satan's all done, Satan is going to look back and say, oh no, everything I did, every clever strategy I did turned out to help and facilitate God's plan, which is to save eternally all his people. And in the process, benefit all his people. I mentioned that a couple weeks ago. It isn't just that he's saving us all. We all will eternally have benefited from the suffering that we undergo on earth. Somebody asked me one day, why do I still teach when my wife's so sick? And I said, because what I'm teaching is the biggest comfort I have in life, which is all pain and suffering that we endure is for our eternal good, and we will benefit forever. And the pain and suffering ends pretty quickly because we don't live that long. It may seem like it while you're living it. Actually, when you get to be my age, it doesn't seem that long anymore. But the good news is we suffer loss for a season in order to suffer gain forever, which turns out to be a wonderful thing. And every Christian, when we are resurrected and we stand with God and with Jesus, will say for eternity, I'm better off because of what happened, no matter how painful it was at the time. And now, don't get me wrong. That doesn't mean we like it. We don't like the pain. We're not nuts. But that's a great comfort. Gracious Lord, we glorify your name and we honor you. There is none like you. You have died and suffered more than any of us suffer, that we might live. You walk with us. You empathize with us. You feel the pain of your people through all of history, that we might live and benefit. Glory to your holy name. Worthy are you to be praised, now and forever. Amen.